Coming up today, flying cars, Mark Zuckerberg wants your skin, 3D printed zoetropes, and something new from Wired. You're listening to episode 314 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
We should start the show this week. Matt Burgess, having recovered from your ailments, you're going to be running the London Marathon on Sunday.
I am, and hopefully I'll be finishing it as well as running it.
That is the idea, I presume. There's a certain deja vu. Former Wired digital editor Michael Rundle ran the London Marathon a couple of years ago. He had a time prediction and an actual time, so I'm going to ask the same of you, just to, you know, put a little bit of added pressure on.
What I'm going for is 3.5 hours, which is which is 5 minutes slower than Tim Peake did in space last year.
Okay, so you're sort of setting yourself near to Tim Peake.
Yeah, but not that near to him.
How would you compare to Michael Rundle?
I don't know what Michael did it in, but I'm going to say better.
Because we'll have to track him down and find out. Best of luck. And you're running for a charity as well. You should mention that.
I am. I'm running for a charity called Deafblind UK, which supports people with visual and audio impairments.
And if you want to sponsor Matt, I'm sure you can find the link on his Twitter, at MattBurgess1.
Yes, that's the one.
There you go. Roland, you also have some news of sorts.
Yes. So, Wired, we are going to be launching a new Wired Politics podcast, just for the moment in the lead-up to the general election.
In the UK. So anyone outside of the UK might like to listen in to see the sheer chaos that is British politics at the moment, but it will be of specific interest to people in this country.
We might talk about the French election as well. Who knows?
Oh, really?
We're still working it out at the moment.
Beyond borders. But the real focus is that Theresa May has called a snap general election, which is going to happen on June 8th. And you were originally planning to do this discussing issues around Brexit, but now there's an awful lot more interest.
Exactly. I mean, you've probably noticed that there's just an insane level of politics around. It's all over the place. It's impossible to escape from. And also that it seems increasingly that technology is influencing politics. I mean, in fact, it sometimes seems as if, we've got a gigantic crisis in which all our old understandings, even about the very nature of democracy, are being threatened. And it can seem sometimes as if technology is to blame. I mean, not just social media, but, what Donald Trump calls the cyber, or gigantic platforms taking over the functions of government.
Technology is definitely nearby, and it's sort of untangling it.
Yes, exactly. And then I think as well, in the kind of the technology sector, the technology sector often seemed like a safe, clean, secure place away from the messy realities of politics. And now politics is definitely starting to intrude in that, raising all sorts of difficult, kind of slightly impossible to answer questions. I mean, should Twitter ban Donald Trump? Should Google pay journalistic publications doing the work of democracy for using their articles? Should WhatsApp make its messages accessible to authorities the way that Amber Rudd would like? These are all kind of tough questions that keep on coming up all the time.
And I guess they're questions that we tried to tackle on the podcast a number of times. But the difference here is that we're going to be getting some people with an awful lot more authority to come in and talk about them.
Exactly. And so in the lead up to the election, and probably a little bit afterwards, we're going to be having a new weekly podcast where we speak to people who really know their stuff about this area, the intersection between technology and politics. And we'll be starting next week with Baroness Martha Lane Fox, who is a board member of Twitter, the founder of lastminute.com and .everyone, and also is behind this new venture, More United, which is crowdfunding to support politicians that they say support their values of openness and tolerance. So it'll be really interesting to see what she thinks about these big questions, but also on the specifics of the general election and how technology will affect that.
The first episode is going to be coming out next week, and it will be available on the main Wired UK podcast feed, and then we're going to split it off onto a separate channel so people will be able to listen in. So do keep an eye out for that and let us know what you think.
Yes, please do.
You can find Roland on Twitter. You're at Rolls Manthorpe.
Well remembered.
I've learnt them all this week. I haven't really. Facts. We normally start with facts. Let's do facts. Matt Burgess.
I've got a running fact, so just to continue that theme from earlier. Apparently, more people have climbed Mount Everest than run a mile in under 4 minutes.
Cool. Good stuff. I mean, surely there are people that have run a mile in under 4 minutes that just haven't really made a big song and dance about it, though.
Probably, yeah. But it's, well, I don't know. If you're going to be that quick, then you might as well make a song and dance out of it.
All right, if I start my watch now, we'll give you 4 minutes.
Okay, I'll be back. I'll be back shortly.
All right.
I'll
so be back in 10 minutes. Don't say anything, yeah. And we'll give the impression. Roland, what did you learn this week?
I learned a couple of things. I learned something which it turned out that everyone else knew but was mind-blowing to me, which was that the dot in your Gmail address does not matter. Oh, you're nodding like you knew this already.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Everyone knew this, not me, and it was shocked me to the very core. So, but in case you don't know this, basically what it means is, say, for example, if you were james.temperton@gmail.com, then you could just have james.temperton@gmail.com. The dot is meaningless. You could have j.a. And on and on and on. That's because the dots don't matter.
And it's a really good way of sorting your emails if you want to get really nerdy about it.
Oh, so you mean...
could subscribe to all your email newsletters with, if you were Roland.Manthorpe, you could put the dot in and then they would automatically go to a certain place because they had a different sender address.
Oh, that is good. Yeah, because I've got a separate spam address that I give to things when I want to subscribe but not really get the emails.
There
so I use that, yeah.
Do you have another fact?
Oh, yes, I do. And this is less technologically related. I learnt the location of the three places in Britain where you can get a sea burial.
Planning on going anywhere?
Well, I don't know. I mean, well, actually, to be honest, is that if I had ever liked the idea, the thought of a sea burial, now, having heard the details through a friend of mine who was talking to his mum about this, I'm not so keen because it all sounds pretty complicated. Basically, you've got to go to either, hang on, let me get this right. I think it's either Tyneside, Southampton, or the Isle of Wight. And then you've got to have a whole bunch of holes drilled in your coffin, a great big lump of concrete put in there, and then they take you out and chuck you over the side. So it's not quite the Viking, Game of Thrones with the guy firing the burning arrow style that I'd kind of pictured.
Well, you could have that at the end. It's just you have to go through a certain process beforehand.
I mean, we quite had to fire burning arrows at a coffin filled with concrete sinking rapidly into the sea.
You'd have to be quite quick. I didn't learn anything this week. So
can I give you something else? Going back to Roland's email thing.
Just to shame you for not having learned anything.
Yeah, yeah, Matt's bought extra facts.
You can learn that my alter ego for my spam address, email address, is called Steve.
Cool.
So, that's it.
So it's what, Steve Burgess?
No, it's not the same surname. I'm not saying the surname because I don't want to get more spam.
Oh, so you've got an entire alter ego for spam?
Yeah, there's a surname as well.
Should build out the personality of this Steve.
Oh, I've got a feeling that Matt already has.
And he was born in 1974.
Next week on the YGK podcast, you can join Steve.
Exactly. Well, you know, Sanders, how we have Jeremy on this podcast. That's not actually Jeremy, that's just Matt.
One of Matt's alter egos,
exactly.
Our first story this week, flying cars, or as they're better known, planes. Matt, tell us some more.
So this week, a company in Germany called Lilium, which has got around 40 people, it's a startup, launched is probably a good word, its flying vehicle. It's effectively a taxi, or what they want to develop into a taxi. It looks a bit like a plane crossed with a car, but there are no wheels, it doesn't go on roads. So it's effectively a plane. They've launched a plane, which they're going to develop into a taxi service, apparently.
So they've launched a plane that they've made to sound a bit like a car, and which everyone that's written about it has made to sound a bit like a car, but what they've actually made is a plane.
Yeah, there is no way that this is actually a flying car.
It's a plane that takes off vertically.
Yeah, so
it's the key innovation here.
It is quite cool as a plane and as a concept. It's eventually, this company says they want to develop it into an on-demand taxi service.
Oh, of course,
in the sky, where you probably go onto an app, you press where your location is, and like Uber, this taxi thing comes flying through the sky, lands, pick you up, and takes you where you want to go. But they actually tested their prototype for the first time this week, and they flew a few flights over the sort of German countryside
with no one in it.
With nobody in it, it was remote controlled. It could be autonomous, but apparently they have to for regulation. People and their safety. They want it to be completely controlled by a human still. Mm-hmm. But it takes off vertically. It's got some. It's all powered by electric. It's completely batteries on board. And its jets, basically, the thrusters point down when it's mm-hmm. on a landing platform, and it takes off vertically. And then it can turn its thrusters, and so they're facing horizontally, and it will go forwards or backwards, well, forwards, and turn in different directions.
At 300 kilometres an hour?
Well, that's the predictive thing. I don't think it's actually gone that far yet. So the prototype they created was big enough to fit humans in, but they say that the one that they're going to create next and going to test in Germany and elsewhere will be five-seater, or that's the aim for it to be five-seater in this big vision of it being a flying taxi.
So a range of 300 kilometres and a possible cruising velocity of 300 kilometres an hour. So you'd be able to get from, how far is 300 kilometres in old money? It's about 180 miles, maybe a little
sounds
more.
About right, yeah.
Sounds about right.
Where can that take you to? Manchester? I'm sorry, I don't have a clue.
It could definitely get you, it could hook up cities. Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, the videos look cool.
Yeah, the thing is, it is quite a cool plane that takes off in sort of a different way to other vehicles. Well, there are other planes that take off vertically, but
they cost a bit of money.
Yeah, the company is saying that theirs is electric, which hasn't been done before in this sort of flying mechanism and takeoff and landing process. Yeah. So that's what they're trying to say is different about this. They've obviously got this bigger vision, which is a long way off being a reality, because there are so many different hurdles that need to be overcome before they even create an actual working version that can have humans flying in it.
Yes, and that's probably partly to blame for the way that the thing has been PR'd, and partly to blame the way that publications have written about it. This is still, excuse the pun, but it's very, very pie in the sky stuff, right? It's a long, long way in the future. We're maybe talking a decade before this kind of thing's realised. Much as they might like to pretend that it will be coming sooner, there are some huge technical and regulatory problems to overcome before this is a reality.
Yeah, and I think, like, actually, if you look at how people predicted drones will be doing deliveries, they're still a long way off in reality at the moment. I know Amazon and other companies have done tests, and there are tests of drones delivering stuff in more rural locations. But for cities and for people to be inside actually flying transport, which is low level and only moves a few hundred miles, there's still a very long way to go in terms of it actually being able to work. But this is still quite cool, yeah. In a way. Like, if you haven't seen the videos, go out, look at them, wire.co.uk, and the videos are everywhere else as well.
But do find them on wire.co.uk.
Yes.
Thank you.
Please pay our wages.
Yeah, so there was an awful lot of excitement around this week. And the interesting thing from the statements that were put out by the people that are working on it, they spoke to our colleagues at Wired Germany, was that they want to, and this is often a word that startups will come up with, they want to democratise access to this kind of technology here. It's not just for people that can afford a private plane already. It's for you and me. Just to hail a taxi with our phones, it will be for everyone. And that to me is the really striking part of this announcement. Roland, you're furrowing your brow somewhat cynically. But if that is their intention, then it's certainly an interesting way to go, rather than turning this into a luxury product that, for example, might be able to shuttle you between hotels in Las Vegas or Dubai.
Yeah, it's a classic example, a use of that word, democratize. So take something which is already owned by everyone, the sky, break it up into small bits, own them, and then sell them off for people to use, but call it democratization.
We'll get more onto that later. Our second story this week. A few months ago, I met an artist called Matt Collishaw, who a lot of you might know for his breakthrough piece, which was Bullet Hole, which appeared in Damien Hirst's somewhat seminal Freeze show in 1988. Well, he didn't just stop there. He's been going ever since. And I caught up with him to find out about his two latest projects, one of which we feature a stunning image of in the latest issue of Wired magazine. It's a giant room-sized 3D printed zoetrope. As it would happen, Roland and I took a little wander at lunch to go and visit it. It's literally across the square from where Wired's offices are, so it was high time that I actually went and saw the thing that I interviewed someone about. And it's a really amazing piece of work, isn't it?
Sorry, I'm going to butt in. I don't know what a zoetrope is.
Ah, sorry, yes, I should slow down.
Oh, Matt Burgess.
So, Matt, if you were old enough and you were alive in Victorian times, you might have sat...
be really old.
Yeah, you might have sat on an evening, and rather than playing Xbox, you might have played zoetrope. So a zoetrope is... It's a trick of the eye. A series of images, you spin it around by hand traditionally, and a series of images pass through a slit where you put your eye, and the trick is that it creates like a strobe effect, and the flashing effect, once spun quick enough, appears to make the objects move. So there'll be a drawing of, say, a woman on a horse, and each drawing will be a tiny little bit different, and as it spins, you look through the hole and you see what appears to be a moving image. So in Victorian times, this would have been the equivalent of playing Halo or Call of Duty.
It turns out I do know what a zoetrope is, but I just don't know the word zoetrope.
Yeah,
it's,
word.
It's one of those kind of like stages on the path to cinema type things.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, and you know, I like the classic draw something in the corner of a book and then watch it all flick by. Yeah, except so, this one is 3D printed.
Yes, yeah, so if you take that to the extreme, then you make something that's, I think, slightly taller than I am, so more than 6 foot tall, and really, really imposing. So what Matt Collishall's done is he's created a series of 3D printed scenes where each one is ever so slightly different, and then put them onto this huge sculpture that's been hand painted. And what it shows is birds of paradise in the act of courtship and flowers. Sort of in the act of blooming and contracting, kind of reverse blooming, which you, what would the word be? Opening and closing would probably be the better way to put it. So it's a remarkable piece of work. He was explaining to me that 3D printing was really the only way that he could do this, to create these very, very intricate scenes. And the way it works is that rather than having a slit that you look at through things through, you stand in a completely dark room and are pelted by strobe lights. So you stand there, this thing spins up to speed, and then the strobe lights come on. And once the strobe lights fit perfectly with the movement, with the spin of the zoetrope, you see what appears to be movement, but in this slightly disconcerting, glitchy, almost claymation way.
Yeah, it's really cool. And I'm actually kind of weirdly fascinated by that era of visual technology, because it's a bit like there are so many sort of precursors to things that we're really excited about now. Like there were early versions of VR called stereoscopes, mm-hmm. which basically kind of put an image on one eye and an image on another eye, and you put them together and it creates like a slightly 3D thing. Yeah, so Abraham Lincoln's funeral, there's a stereoscope of that. Or to put it in modern parlance, you can now watch Abraham Lincoln's funeral on VR.
Yeah, but just sort of VR with two planes.
Yeah, exactly. And also, is that all the claims that the marketing people around those things made then, they're making now. So they would say, it's like you're literally there. This technology is completely immersive. You won't even know the difference between your reality and the reality you're seeing. So it's funny to hear those same claims repeated again. I think it kind of gives like an interesting historical perspective on the things that we take to be so marvellous now and how crap they'll look 100 years in the
future. I've actually got a stereoscope at home that was given to me by an elderly relative. It's made of Formica. It's horrible brown plastic.
Those kind of, because they kind of like came into fashion again in like the 60s or something.
Yeah, I think it's from then, and you can sort of go on a grand tour of Europe in the stereoscope. I'll bring it in and we can all have a play. So the zoetrope that we're talking about is Centrifugal Soul by Matt Collishall. It's on display at Blaine's Southern in London until May 27th. I thoroughly recommend going and seeing it. It's unnerving and really, really rather marvellous. Something else he's working on for the Photo London exhibition at Somerset House in London, which starts towards the end of next month, is a virtual reality recreation of the world's first major photography exhibit. And this is a really, really ambitious project. So he wants to create a room-sized VR exhibition where you put on a headset and you wander around with other visitors and you experience this scene from 150, 180 years ago, whatever it is. And it all feels real. So there are props to mimic the physical objects that you're looking at. So when you bump into things, you're actually bumping into things. You'll be able to see the ghost-like figures of the other people who appear as avatars in virtual reality. So similar to 3D printing, which he said had only just recently reached the level of finesse and accuracy that was necessary to do this kind of project, he says that VR is now coming to the kind of time where it's developed enough that artists can start to play with it and experiment with it.
Which is an interesting thing to say, given that this thing opens on 18th of May and you spoke to him a couple of months ago and he hadn't even started work on it.
Well, so he was already building the virtual world.
Oh, okay, right.
But so what he hadn't chosen was the technology. And this was the real difficulty, was that how... Because it's kind of ambitious, right? And Roland, you know an awful lot about virtual reality, having spent most of the last few months hiding inside it. How do you...
I wasn't hiding inside it. I was living a full and real life.
Yeah, definitely. Sure.
My new friends.
Yeah.
Who don't bully me like you.
But how do you get that... How do you get people to interact with each other in virtual reality? How do you... The sheer computational power needed to get lots of different live actors moving around inside virtual reality so you don't bump into each other, so that it doesn't feel disorientating. And how do you use physical objects and sound and even heat? So there's going to be a fire in the exhibition.
Will there?
Well, that was one of the things he wanted to do. And just to recreate it, he was just going to have a fan heater.
Okay. Just
to make that corner of the room warmer.
Because I was telling you about it earlier. I went to this VR trade show yesterday, and I chatted to some people who've been working for 3 years on something similar, and it didn't have even half these features. So, I mean, if you can do all this, it's going to be incredible. I can't wait, but I don't believe it.
Well, you don't have to wait long. It opens at Somerset House in London on May 18th before touring around the country a little bit, places like Birmingham, Chippenham, Bradford and Oxford. And it aims to create William Fox Talbot's 1839 show at King Edward's School in Birmingham. So it was a real seminal moment for technology. And using the latest technology, the idea is that art can take us back to it. Remains to be seen how successful it is, but it'll be interesting to find out in a month or so. You can read about Matt Collishaw's work in the latest issue of Wire magazine, and it's also on wire.co.uk, so you can go and find it there as well. Moving swiftly on to our third story this week, and I imagine the one that's going to spark the most debate, Facebook. Facebook this week had its F8 conference. This is Facebook's version of Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference or IBM's Technology Forum, Intel's Technology Forum. It's basically the big Facebook show where the company makes lots of big announcements, but also seeks to engage more broadly with the technology industry. Now, very intriguingly, just hours before Mark Zuckerberg took to the stage, Steve Stevens killed himself. This was the man who sparked a manhunt after posting a video and later a live stream on Facebook in which he killed a man and discussed murdering more than a dozen other people. So Mark Zuckerberg had to step on stage and directly address this very raw and developing issue, and he says we have a lot more to do here, and reminded of this week by the tragedy in Cleveland. He said our hearts go out to the family and friends of Robert Goldwyn Sr., and we will keep doing all we can to prevent tragedies like this from happening. And this really comes down to a big problem for Facebook, is the way that people are using its platform and the way that Facebook is helping the way that Facebook is tackling these kind of problems that are developing on its platform. It hasn't always been seen to be acting as quickly as it might. And when something like this happens, and it is such a horrible, horrible situation, that it really, really brings it into sharp, sharp focus that these platforms, like Roland said at the top of the podcast, are everywhere.
Yeah, I think it was good that Zuckerberg actually addressed this directly head on at pretty much the start of their conference, because it was something that has been massively covered in the media. It is something that the company is going to have to keep addressing and continue to change how its own policies work, how there's a wider discussion about how we use these sort of platforms for live video and posting videos. And to be honest, there's always going to be people that misuse any sort of technology platform, whether it's Facebook, whether it's the dark web for selling drugs or things like that. But it's a wider discussion, I think, that needs to be had. But I think the company should be commended in some ways for stepping up and saying, this is what we're trying to do on it. They've obviously got a lot more to do, as have other companies as well in this space. But it's something that is obviously very horrible and is probably going to happen again at some point.
And very difficult to talk about, because it's an incredibly complex issue, so we won't dwell on it for too long. But something that I should say is our colleague Liat Clark published a really, really good editorial piece on this that's looking more broadly at the issue of how Facebook handles content that's posted onto its network that might be illegal or controversial, and how Facebook's editorial policies and moderation policies are coming under increasing scrutiny and how they're not necessarily up to scratch. It's a really, really good breakdown of what's been happening over the last few years. It's an area that Liat spent an awful lot of time looking into, and I very much recommend that you read it, because it does a lot more justice to this issue than we could on this podcast, I think. So we will move on from that huge, huge issue and on to some other things that caught our eye within the F8 presentation that Mark Zuckerberg and some other Facebook executives gave. Roland, something that you and Ollie Franken-Wallace picked out was not Snapchat at all. Innovation from Facebook.
Exactly. Innovation that could be summed up in the word snap. Because you may have noticed that Snapchat's features somehow keep on finding their way onto Facebook's platforms.
And no one uses them.
Well, yeah, that is true. Have you been onto the, this is slightly jumping ahead, but have you been onto the statuses bit on WhatsApp lately?
No.
A desolate graveyard of a place.
But isn't the status thing is just everyone saying, hi there, I'm using WhatsApp?
No, there's a new Snapchat-like stories element. I'm pretty sure it's called statuses, right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, on WhatsApp, where you can, you know, just post a few photos in a way that's similar to Snapchat.
But that's not why I use WhatsApp.
Well, maybe you should, because at the moment it is very sad and empty. And I'm sure that your friends would like to know what you're up to.
To quickly rewind for people that don't know what any of these features are.
We jumped ahead. Thanks, Matt.
The main feature that Facebook has copied from Snapchat is the idea of having a story where you post pictures and video with text and emoji and stuff all over the top, drawings, anything you want, really. And then it just sort of goes into this feed where you can scroll through each person who's done it and basically see what they've been doing in their day. And
hang on, so we'll just simplify all that down. It's Snapchat.
Yes, it is. But it's now in Instagram. It's now in the main Facebook app. It's now in Facebook Messenger. It's now in WhatsApp.
Yeah. Exactly.
On
Facebook itself. Yes. Lots of people use it on Instagram. The other areas have yet to be seen.
Yes, exactly. And so anyway, I mean, they've been copying Snapchat's features for ages. But on Tuesday, on LF8, Mark Zuckerberg went a step further by unveiling a vision of augmented reality in which, and stop me if this sounds familiar, digital objects and effects are overlaid on images of the real world.
It's called a Snapchat filter, Roland.
Oh, my goodness. No, yeah. It's not, because it's innovation by Facebook.
Yes. So it's an interesting track that Facebook has gone down over the last couple of years in the runaway success of Snapchat and how successful it's seen attracting millennials, these mystical unicorn-like creatures that hide in the forest and only come out at night.
I've never seen one.
No, never seen one. Wouldn't even know what they look like. But they're big, big, big dollars for advertisers, potentially, if anyone can work out a way to successfully monetize them. We saw that in the value of Snap when it did its IPO, and Facebook is very keen to take some of these ideas and iterate around them to come up with innovative new ways of getting people to interact with digital content and advertisers, right?
Yes, exactly. So one example that Zuckerberg used that actually sounds like the sort of thing that people might do is saying that you could share pictures of your run. Oh, Matt Burgess, this is you. And with your pace and time superimposed over the top.
Okay.
That sounds pretty realistic.
Yep.
So he mentioned the day that when you'll be able to leave a review of a restaurant by pinning it digitally to the window. Sounds like a terrible idea. And also, it's also going to provide the most unintentionally depressing moment of F8 when Zuckerberg talked excitedly about the functionality of Facebook's new camera effects platform by saying, you can add a second coffee mug so it looks like you're not having breakfast alone.
I mean, when I interviewed Charlie Brooker, the writer of Black Mirror, a few months ago, he said, I honestly do not read the technology news to come up with ideas. I come up with them and then magically I find that a company has either already done this thing or then announces it afterwards. But if he does need some ideas for the new season of Black Mirror, he might like to just take a quick look at some of the things that Facebook is working on.
Exactly. Yeah, this is interesting in a few ways, both for the kind of the future vision of Facebook, but also, I mean, what it means for Snapchat, because Facebook has got this gigantic, gigantic network-affected platform. And, I mean, they are really going for Snapchat. And like, what was interesting is that so Zuckerberg said, he said, you may have noticed that we rolled out some cameras across our apps recently. That was Act 1. So, as in, basically, we copied your stuff. That was Act 1. But Act 2 is we're going to take your entire vision and do it better. And the entire vision is this idea of augmented reality, which is, I mean, broadly speaking, digital things overlaid in the real world. I thought there's a great writer on this called Ben Thompson, who after F8 compared Snapchat to Apple and Facebook to Microsoft, but in the 90s. So basically, in this comparison, Apple came up with all the ideas, Microsoft stole them and then killed Apple until it was sternly revived by Steve Jobs much later. But It does seem quite accurate, I would say.
There's a degree of point to that, of truth to that. A good way to sum it up is they want to own reality. So this idea that you're walking down a little cobble street in Paris, maybe, and you're trying to find somewhere to eat, but you're wearing a pair of Facebook goggles or Snapchat spectacles, or you're just wafting your phone around in midair and you can see reviews overlaid and pins popping up on things and maybe directions of where to go to get a really nice drink that's cozy and casual and fun for locals, right? These kind of ways that tech companies are trying to sort of box up experiences so that you can more naturally experience the world, albeit through their platform.
Yeah, Zuckerberg said, he used quite an interesting phraseology around this. He said, we all know where we want to get to, and that's the glasses that we wear, where we can basically in some way have our smartphone kind of in front of our eyes all the time. But it's that thing of like, we all know where we want to get to. Like, this is agreed. It's just who gets there fastest. And I mean, you know, out in the strange world of technology, I think that's just about right. I mean, I think that is where everyone bizarrely wants to get to.
It's an arms race, and we've very much, it's a silly term, but it is an arms race, and we've very much seen it
It's an eyes race.
It's an eyes race. We've seen it with artificial intelligence, this field that was traditionally the preserve of academia, but where Facebook and Google and Apple, even though it refuses to admit that it's doing so.
Oh, I thought that it admitted recently that it was interested.
Oh, well, there we go then. So everyone's on board. So all of the big Silicon Valley companies and Microsoft and Amazon on top of that are snapping up all of the talent coming out of American research universities and universities around the world to make sure that they've got the brains to create this artificial brain. And we're probably going to see a similar sort of thing when companies really start to ramp up their efforts to own reality, so that the very way that we see the world can be monetized and has a platform. And Mark Zuckerberg wants that platform to be Facebook. Remains to be seen if it will be Facebook or Snap or Google or Apple or Amazon or someone we haven't heard of yet.
Exactly. I mean, I thought our colleague Ollie Franklin Wallace wrote a furious column about F8, in which he said, I think I got this correctly, the stakes are essentially who can be the first to monetize reality.
Yeah, we tried to get him on the podcast to talk about it, but he's just too angry. He's still fuming.
He is. I think maybe also too tall. Is that an issue?
He's actually gotten taller.
He's grown in rage.
Yeah, his rage has caused him to swell up.
Exactly. Yeah, Matt Burgess, you're a millennial. I hear a rumour that you're a millennial. Do you use Snapchat?
I don't use Snapchat at all, actually. Well, I've got it on my phone. I used to use it a little bit, but now have just sort of gone off it. Not for any particular reason, but I think I was an early adopter. All these new features came in and they just got a bit too much for me. But I use Instagram Stories, which is obviously Instagram's, Facebook's version of it for its own photo platform. And all of this seems to be about the camera, really. That's where all the efforts are going at the moment. Everybody wants to be taking photos and videos and sharing them rather than texts or anything else at the second.
Yeah. I mean, because from their point of view, it's as simple as when you put a word in, that word is just that word. But when you take a photo, it's got all this data, all this information that is extra. And new machine learning techniques can read these images and see things in them. And that's more data for the platform. And I mean, from their point of view, more data to help you live your life more fully. That's what they all say. The camera is what, in a way that the smartphone just is a camera. That's kind of what we will understand is essential about it. And it's interesting to think about, say, like that time, whenever it was, when we realized that we could search through text on computers, and all the things that sprung out of that, all the many, many things that came out of that. Well, now we're getting to the point where we can search through images.
And in real time. That's
exactly.
What the vision
yes.
is.
Yeah. And then, there are some people, actually, because I cycle, and you see it a lot with cyclists, they have a GoPro on top of their head. And so you keep that GoPro on all the time, and then you'd always be able to search, to, you know, you like something that you'd seen a few weeks ago, and you were like, oh, I wonder where that shop was. And you can sort of, in some way, Google, search for that shop that you saw, and you'll be able to find that. I mean, but that's just even like the most basic level of imagination of what you could create using this technology.
Let's fling ourselves even further into the future. Mark Zuckerberg also wants your skin to turn into a series of attractive bijou lamps. One can only presume. Who wants to take this one on?
Oh, go on, I will. Because I thought this was something else that I learned this week. Another fact for you, that there are apparently 2 square meters of skin on the human body.
That's a lot of lamps.
Yeah, it is.
We should start right there. Mark Zuckerberg does not want to turn people into bijou lamps. I mean, he might. There's a chance. But this isn't why he wants your skin.
No, so at F8, there were 2 very, very out there, very sci-fi-ish sounding proposals that Facebook put forward as well. So one of them was about skin, as we've mentioned, and basically Facebook says that they want to use the skin on the human body to turn it into a listening device, which sounds absolutely ridiculous.
Yes.
But there is some science behind this, and there is some development going into it, and the basic thinking behind it is your skin is full of sensors. It reacts to temperature, touch, pretty much, well, it reacts to anything, really. And they want to be able to convert or use these sensors with other technology to be able to make it listen, which...
So you'll be able to hear using your skin, or to put it another way, to quote Regina Dugan, who used to head up DARPA and also work for Google, but now is sort of head of Facebook's Ridiculous Ideas project. Over the next 2 years, we'll be building systems that demonstrate the capability to type at 100 words per minute by decoding neural activity devoted to speech. So this is the other project that they're working on, which is the idea that you'll type using your brain.
Which would be useful.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it might make offices a bit weird.
If you can type using your brain, why are you typing?
Well, you need to get the words down somehow.
But do you know what I mean? Like, honestly, that sounds like it's like, I can fly, so what I'm going to do is kind of pluck the leaves off the trees. Or so, I mean, it's a bad comparison.
So you're getting poetic. I tuned out there for a moment.
I'm just thinking that if you have like a genuine brain computer interface, I'm not sure that what you'll really be using it for is typing. But anyway, I mean, this is all science fiction stuff, so who knows?
So in Silicon Valley, this is what they refer to as a moonshot. But as Facebook says, over the next 2 years, so we'll be holding them to this. And in 2 years, if Mark Zuckerberg doesn't stand up at the front and have a big projection screen behind him, touch his temples, and his thoughts just appear on the wall behind him, and then everyone in deathly silence, and he listens to them muttering using his skin.
That's a different world.
It's only 2 years away.
They've been working on it for 6 months. So really, they're a fifth of the way there.
Mm. Yeah. So there's a degree to which companies, and Google is very good at this, use these kind of exercises for incredibly good PR. So it looks great to make these kind of announcements. It makes Facebook appear to be a very exciting company doing really exciting work, which undoubtedly in some ways it is. So for one, it looks good publicly, which is also good news if you want to attract the best talent. Because if you're going to achieve these very ambitious goals, you need some really, really smart people to do it. And Facebook is up against Google and Apple and Microsoft and blah, 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 in order to attract these brains, in order to make my skin listen and my brain type.
Oh, it's a big thing though in Silicon Valley right now. I mean, or you know, in kind of the wider world of technology, the brain computer interface. I mean, Elon Musk has got one. Basically, you're no one in Silicon Valley right now if you don't have a brain computer interface. And I mean, from what I understand of the technology, it is plausible, right? Like, because the thing is that at the moment you can do something like this, but you've got to do a surgical implant inside the brain, and they're basically, that's the challenge for them is how to do a non-surgical interface between the brain and a computer.
Yeah, it's to do with interpreting the signals that the brain puts out so that a computer can work with them and also communicate back.
Yeah, and I thought the most amusing part of it all was when they reassured people that they wouldn't be listening to your thoughts, because it would just be, they said it was just in the speech centers, so it would only pick up the thoughts that you had, the words that you had thought that you were going to put down.
Okay.
And I think the comparison was just like you take a lot of photos, but you only share one.
Oh, that's very neat, isn't it?
It is. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's basically like the Instagram for the brain.
Mm.
Yeah.
Strong pitch.
We'll all be sitting there for hours and hours and hours crafting that one word that we eventually release through our computer brain interface.
I dread to think.
In fact, I'm going to start thinking of my one word now so that I'm ready in 2 years just to release it.
Or is it... what a word it will be.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, we're being a little bit cynical here, so we should perhaps target that cynicism. For me, what would be really great to see these technology companies do as well is to put a lot of focus on the big problems that are very, very significant now. So we mentioned at the top of this the issue of someone filming a murder and putting it on Facebook's platform, but that fits into a whole broader problem as to how Facebook moderates itself, how Facebook uses algorithms to determine what content is popular, what people should be seeing, and these are really, really critical issues for these platforms. And while it might sound it might be eye-catching and quite sexy to stand up and talk about someone's skin being able to listen or someone's brain being able to type, the really, really big problems that Facebook and Google and Twitter and Microsoft have to solve are all around accountability for algorithms, are around moderation, are around echo chambers, these big issues, some of which Roland will be tackling on the new Wired UK Politics podcast.
Oh my goodness, that was seamless.
It was almost as if I had it planned.
Did you just bring that back around to the beginning?
Just right off the top of my head.
Whoa.
Yeah, I was just typing it out in thin air while listening to you through my skin.
I have no chance of managing this level of competency on the Wild Politics podcast.
Yeah, it will just be Roland. So Roland's going solo. As we mentioned at the top of the show, you can listen to that.
Creative
next
differences.
Week.
I think that anyone who's been listening to this for a while will have heard the tension bubbling under the surface.
There's blood on the walls, folks. Every week. We will see you again next week twice. Once for this podcast and once for Roland Manthorpe's Politics Extravaganza. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.